I'm Jillian Ma.
And I'm Eliana Biscard Church.
This week on War News Radio, under new management, Amandine Lee takes a look at the new government in Iraq.
And they actually succeeded in voting for a new coalition that is not one of the ruling coalitions to change the government. If after all of this, nothing changes, I think people will not see the point of participating in elections anymore.
Then, in the second installment of our new media analysis series, Aaron Moser examines the coverage of President Obama's trip to Afghanistan.
Perhaps it was not dust storms, but the turbulent political atmosphere that kept President Obama from visiting Kabul. The president's visit came just days after the publication of diplomatic cables that revealed growing U.S. concern over corruption within the Afghan government, and days before the White House released its report on the states of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Finally, we speak to medical students who are part of the Army's Health Profession Scholarship Program.
People enjoy their experience, and it's medically, it's very rewarding, and you learn a lot.
But first, this week's news.
Next week, the White House's annual review of the Afghanistan war will evaluate the success of U.S. strategy in the country. Late last year, President Obama authorized a troop increase of 30,000 soldiers. According to a senior defense official, the review is expected to conclude that the increased U.S. presence has made progress in improving security, especially around Kabul.
In anticipation of the study's release, President Obama and Defense Secretary Gates visited Afghanistan in separate trips. Obama spoke with U.S. troops and talked to Afghan President Hamid Karzai over the phone. Gates met with U.S. soldiers and commanders in eastern and southern Afghanistan. He expressed optimism about U.S. strategy, stating that efforts to fight the Taliban have exceeded his expectations. Gates also met with Karzai, complimenting him for his surprisingly statesmanlike response to the recently leaked cables.
Iyad Alawi has threatened to quit the Iraqi government created by the recently implemented power-sharing agreement. Alawi was promised the head position of a newly created body, the Higher Council for National Policies. Alawi expressed discontent with his role in the new government, stating that if the position is not more than simply advisory, he will not participate. Alawi wants a guarantee that the Higher Council will have the power to take part in important decisions and serve as a check on the Prime Minister. Alawi was not present at a parliament session this past Saturday, during which parliament approved the outline for the new government. U.S. officials worry that without Alawi's participation, Iraq's new government will be seen as illegitimate and unrepresentative.
An arrest was finally made in the highly publicized Afghan disfigurement case of Aisha, a young woman who gained international recognition after appearing on the August 9th cover of Time magazine as a victim of violence. The father-in-law of Aisha was arrested for slicing off Aisha's nose and ears after she ran away from her abusive husband. Not much legal action was expected to happen in Aisha's case, since the crime took place in an area under Taliban control. However, Afghan law enforcement was able to make an arrest when the father-in-law recently went to a bazaar in Khora district, an area within the government's jurisdiction. With the help of donations from various aid groups, Aisha is currently living in Brooklyn while she receives psychological treatment and awaits reconstructive surgery.
Diplomatic cables recently released by WikiLeaks indicate that Iraq's neighbors have consistently interfered in internal Iraqi politics. In the cables, Iraqi officials worry that regional neighbors, particularly Iran, are trying to influence the Iraqi parliament. Officials assert that nearby countries have often financed Iraq's political parties in order to gain influence in Iraqi politics and prevent Iraq from reemerging as a strong regional power. In one of the most dramatic statements released, Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki accused Iran of trying to control the Iraqi parliament by arranging an alliance between Iraq's two major Shiite voting blocs. Other diplomatic cables show that leaders of some neighboring countries, including Turkey and Saudi Arabia, distrust al-Maliki and the Iraqi government.
the Afghan government has backed away from its plan to ban private security contractors. In August, President Karzai announced that private security companies in Afghanistan would be almost entirely replaced by Afghan police by the end of the year. However, the government recently announced that many current contractors would be allowed to continue to work until their contracts expire. This decision comes after development groups threatened to stop operating in Afghanistan, arguing that security contractors were necessary to ensure the safety of their workers.
The U.S. Agency for International Development recently suspended all contracts with the Academy for Educational Development, AED, while it investigates the organization's questionable practices. AED is a nonprofit group that has contracts with U.S. government agencies to run health, education, social, and economic development programs in about 150 countries. AED is one of the key contractors in Afghanistan overseeing higher education programs, receiving $109 million for contracts in Afghanistan over the past 3 years. Inspectors have found serious corporate misconduct from AED, including illegal collusion between AED and its vendors.
The U.S. Senate failed to reach the 60 votes necessary in order to avoid filibuster on a defense bill that would have ended the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. The final tally was 57-40, with all but one Republican voting against the bill. Most Senate Republicans united against the bill following procedural disputes between party leadership. After the rejection of the larger defense bill, Senators Susan Collins and Joe Lieberman announced that they will introduce a standalone bill centered only on repealing the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. Senator Collins told journalists that she expected to get over 60 votes on the new bill.
The UN Assistance Mission in Afghanistan released a new report on the status of women in Afghanistan that paints a bleak picture. The report found that despite the passage of a law to eliminate violence against women, Afghan women are still suffering from harmful practices such as honor killings and forced child marriages. The report also states that Afghan government is not doing enough to protect women. Based on 150 interviews conducted this year in 29 of Afghanistan's 34 provinces, the report found that the police and courts are still reinforcing harmful practices instead of carrying out the new law.
War News Radio. The inconclusive elections in Iraq this March have yielded a new president and prime minister, except neither man is actually new and neither belongs to the coalition that won the elections. Amandine Lee brings us more on the deal that resolved the stalemate in Iraqi politics and its implications for the future of Iraq.
For the 8 months from March to November 2010, the Iraqi government was paralyzed by a simple math problem. Four major coalitions did almost equally well in the elections, each attaining between 22 and 28% of the vote. But there are only three major offices available to fill: president, prime minister, and speaker of parliament. The issue was finally resolved, it seems, with the advent of a fourth position. Raya Jarar, an Iraqi-American independent journalist and activist based in Washington, D.C., describes the new job.
It's called the National Council for Strategic Policy, and this fourth position will be headed by Dr. Allawi, the former Prime Minister of Iraq. So this is the political deal that the different coalitions reached to include the four winning coalitions. It is being formed in accordance to a constitutional article that allows the executive branch to create new entities.
Ayad Alawi's State of Law Coalition placed first in the elections. As a result, his participation is seen as key for the government to maintain what little legitimacy it has. But the authority Alawi's new post will hold is unclear. Ali Abdul, an Iraqi translator working for the U.S. Army in Baghdad, voices the public's uncertainty in this new settlement.
It just promises, man. It just promises. Nothing came through yet. Just promises. Maybe they will not make any position for him. Even if they make that position, even if they make that position for him, so he just name kind of. He don't have any power in that position.
The The breakthrough came for Iraq in mid-November, when Kurdish leader Jalal Talabani was re-elected as president of the republic, and Sunni Osama el-Najafi was elected Speaker of Parliament. 2 weeks later, on Thanksgiving Day in America, Talabani asked Shiite Nouri al-Maliki, Iraq's prime minister since 2006, to form the new government. He has until December 25th to put a cabinet together. But this chronological narrative does not capture how the solution was really found. In Iraq, each position cannot be decided on its own. Every group demands to play a role in the government, or threatens to leave, so it's like four different parties have the ability to filibuster any agreement. So, Jarar explains, with the help of regional representatives and even President Obama, a deal was reached before Talabani's election.
And that deal was a package. The package included deciding who will run the parliament, who will run who will become the president of the republic, and who will become the prime minister, and the creation of the new council and deciding who's the head of the new council. Deciding even some outlines for the for creating the cabinet, how many ministers will each coalition take.
Though Maliki gained the largest number of individual votes in the election, and Iraq has a complicated system whereby constituents can vote for either individuals or a party ticket, his State of Law coalition actually narrowly placed second. This means that many people mistrust Maliki as prime minister, including Ali Abdul.
He's the new dictator for Iraq. The prime minister should be out of law because he won his last update. They are just guns, and they turn around Alawi and they took his place as a prime minister.
However, Shada al-Musawi, former member of parliament, does not consider Alawi qualified for the job either.
He was a member of the Iraqi parliament in the previous round, but he didn't attend any one session, though he was the head of a bloc, and he has more than 30 seats. He didn't try to change anything.
One of Maliki's advantages is that he does not appear beholden to any one foreign influence. The three main groups that contested Iraq's elections in 2005 were generally associated with the Sunnis, Shiites, and Kurds. But the Shiites split when Maliki broke from the heavily Iran-backed Iraqi National Alliance in 2009. Neither does Maliki spend all his time in pro-Western countries, as Alawi does. Regardless, the stagnancy in Iraqi politics shows a lack of strong democratic infrastructure. There is no guarantee that the prime minister's office, which previously held less authority, will stop accruing power. Or, as Rara Jarar says, that parties will pay attention to the polls.
We shouldn't forget that the first elections that took place in 2005, more than 3/4 of the Iraqi public showed up in the polls. This election, it was still a high number. It was around 65% of the Iraqi public, which is, believe it or not, higher than our numbers here in the U.S. Although Iraq had explosions and assassinations, but I think if after all of this sacrifice and people going to the polls and people, trying to participate in the political process, and they actually succeeded in voting for a new coalition that is not one of the ruling coalitions to change the government. If after all of this, nothing changes, I think people they will not see the point of participating in elections anymore.
Meanwhile, backroom deals and absence of transparency alienate the Iraqi public. Abdul himself has been discouraged by Iraq's system and was one of the 45% of the electorate that did not vote in the last elections.
Well, because I didn't count any one of them, any one of the candidates are representing me, or I feel him like he's honest. Not all of them, but the majority of them. I feel like I think they are thieves. They just try to use those people on being in the government so they can use the Iraqi fortune, the oil, everything just for themselves. And they don't care anything about the people.
Riyad Jarar sees the 2014 elections as an indicator for Iraq's future.
The next Iraqi elections that will take place 3 years from now, believe it or not, we wasted a full year on creating this government. 1 out of 4 years was wasted on creating the government. The next one in 3 years will be the final judgment for Iraqis, whether they have functional government institutions or whether they have, the same three or four faces that will continue. run the country for the next decades.
In those next 3 years, Iraq has many challenges to overcome. While politicians negotiate, everyday Iraqis deal with power shortages, lack of health care, lack of education, unemployment, and lack of security. Meanwhile, all U.S. forces, combat and not, are slated to leave Iraq by the end of 2011. Therefore, Iraq has little hope of rebuilding itself without a working, legitimate government. For War News Radio, I'm Amandine Lee.
This is War News Radio. Last week, Karim Sarayamed debuted the first in a series of media analyses by looking at the media coverage of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. This week, Aaron Moser continues the series by looking at the coverage of President Obama's trip to Afghanistan.
On December 3rd, President Obama made a surprise visit to Afghanistan, only his second presidential trip to the nation.
Hello, everybody! It is great to be back, and I apologize for keeping you guys up late, coming on such short notice, but I want to make sure that I could spend a little time this holiday with the men and women of the finest fighting force that the world has ever known.
NPR's Ari Shapiro reported from Bagram Air Base that the agenda of the trip was changed due to inclement weather.
President Obama is in the country of Afghanistan for a total of 3 hours. It was originally supposed to be twice that length. He was going to helicopter to Kabul and back in order to meet with embassy workers and President Hamid Karzai at the presidential palace in Kabul. But because of weather, that part of the trip was canceled. Instead, he came here, he visited a hospital and delivered Purple Hearts to some wounded warriors there. He met with some troops who had lost comrades just this past week. And then he spoke to 3,000 or so troops here in this hangar.
Other American news sources like PBS and CNN reported that weather prevented the meeting of the two leaders. The New York Times cited 45-mile-per-hour wind gusts and limited visibility due to dust clouds. International media sources have been more critical of the official report. Russia Today challenged the claim that weather conditions affected the trip. On Russia Today's Aliona show, the host asked former U.S. Marine Jake Diliberto about the official claims.
Yeah, no, I mean, Bagram Air Force Base is maybe about an hour vehicle ride, and President Karzai takes vehicles all over the place, especially north of Kabul is very safe to drive through. So I don't buy that. But I think, moreover, what's even more ridiculous is that a sandstorm, I mean, I don't think so. Even during the Iraq War, when there was this orange haze, helicopters were still flying during that. So I think that there is some humdiggering going on here.
Perhaps it was not dust storms, but the turbulent political atmosphere that kept President Obama from visiting Kabul. The president's visit came just days after the publication of diplomatic cables that revealed growing U.S. concern over corruption within the Afghan government, and days before the White House released its report on the states of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. This appearance also coincides with bleak domestic employment reports and came in the midst of debate over the United States military's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. Newsweek suggested that, when waylaid by domestic issues, presidents often enjoy an uptick in popularity when they appear with American troops. Appearing on Press TV, a news source funded by the Iranian government, former U.S. Senator Mike Gravel put a tougher spin on Newsweek's line.
It's difficult to see what the purpose of the trip was when you're only doing 4 hours on the ground, other than being a cosmetic trip. It's a bit like these secret trips that Bush took to Iraq, you know, to carry around a rubber turkey and then leave. This is cosmetic.
Whatever the political implications of the president's trip, It is clear that the war in Afghanistan is entering a critical stage. After the four-hour visit, President Obama returned to Washington to continue work on the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty with Russia. For War News Radio, I'm Aaron Moser.
Economic climate, paying for medical school is a daunting task for anyone. For most, the opportunity to graduate debt-free and even receive a stipend for living expenses is a hard one to pass up. But what if it comes at the price of a minimum of 4 years of active military service? That's the premise of the Health Professions Scholarship Program. Kyle Crawford has more in this piece, first aired in July.
Since 1973, the Health Professions Scholarship Program, or HPSP, has been an option for medical students wanting to pursue a career as a military physician. Emily Crawford and I spoke to three med school students who have received the scholarship.
My name is Amina Mogul. I'm currently a third-year medical student. I'm originally from Jersey City, New Jersey.
My name is Kelly Sayano, and I'm from Fort Collins, Colorado.
I am Timothy Gaki, going to begin my first year at PCOM.
Kelly Sayano confirms that yes, the prospect of attending medical school for free is a huge draw for the program.
The financial part is appealing for sure, especially people are strapped with a lot of debt these days in medical school. I see it in my classmates. It's a hard thing, and it affects their decisions about specialties and their ways that they're going to practice.
The financial package that the scholarship offers is indeed tempting. Major Leon Hooten, an HPSP recruiter, outlines the basic requirements and compensation that come with the scholarship.
If you're accepted to medical school, you'll get a full-ride scholarship to any accredited medical school, MD or DO, in the country. You also have a $20,000 upfront signing bonus, as well as about $2,000 given to you 10.5 months of the year. The other 6 months of the year, you're on active duty for training as a second lieutenant, so you make approximately $6,000 or so. So when you add all that up over the course of 4 years of medical school, you're looking at about $120,000, $125,000, something like that.
However, accepting an HPSP scholarship is a major commitment, and money alone is not motivation enough to make it worthwhile. The possibility, and even likelihood given today's political climate, of being deployed demands of scholarship recipients a willingness to serve one's country at the expense of personal comfort and safety. Timothy Gaki expresses his feelings about the prospect of being deployed.
Nobody really wants a war, but, you know, if you can go there and do some pretty good things, then I guess that supports it. I'd be lying if I said I wasn't nervous about the whole prospect of going down there. But that is my duty, and that is something I've come to accept. And if that is what they choose to do, then I am, more than happy to pack my bags and send me on my way, I guess.
While all three scholarship recipients express some level of anxiety about being deployed to a conflict zone, they all seem to have come to terms with the possibility. Siano explains her thought process.
Well, I think most people just aren't quite sure what it's going to be like, so kind of have maybe patches of doubt here and there. But, you know, the good thing is, I think one of the neat things about military medicine is sort of like in a lot of ways, the optimal way to practice medicine. There's not a lot of malpractice situations. You have a lot of resources that you don't have civilian side. Your patients are compliant, and they have access to resources, you know. So I think ultimately people enjoy their experience, and it's very rewarding, and you learn a lot.
For many, the monetary compensation that the program offers is only a bonus that comes with a career that they would have found appealing anyway. Mogul explains that she had always entertained thoughts of working in the military.
Maybe it was because I played with, like, little green army plastic men. I have no clue. I don't know. I always saw them at parades and on TV and stuff like that, and I loved seeing soldiers all lined up and marching in crisp uniforms and stuff like that. It's just, and it's so buried in tradition. The Army is just it's been around as long as our country's been around, and I love where I live. Maybe it was the fact that July 4th is my favorite holiday or something. I'm like a little patriot at heart. I think it was just my calling.
For her, the ability to combine her desire to become a doctor with the appeal that the military holds for her is an ideal situation. Gawky, however, expressed some concern that while he is comfortable with the idea of military life now, the future may hold new complications.
You know, what if I have a family? What if I have, you know, they deploy me in, you know, some awful place? These are unknowns that, you know, no one knows the answer, and no one can guarantee you an answer one way or another. I mean, there's a good chance by the time I'm finished medical school, finished my training, we'll be out of this war and into a different one, you know, hopefully not.
The prospect of becoming directly involved in a war, either current or future, is on the mind of all three med students. However, as Mogul points out, their role in any war will most likely remain a strictly medical one.
I honestly can't even say I have an opinion of the wars, except for the fact that I trust that our troops are doing the right thing. As a doctor, my role is a little bit different, I guess, in my opinion, doesn't matter politically as so much as someone who's on the front line, so to speak, or who's in the infantry, for example. My job, no matter where I'm doing it and when I'm doing it and who I'm taking care of, is to take care of other people's lives. And whether those people are civilians or soldiers, I'm going to do my job.
Attitudes towards the U.S. Army and the current wars aside, interest in military healthcare careers has increased noticeably in recent years. Major Hooten speculates as to why this might be.
I would say that there's some ebbs and flows to it, but definitely over the last couple of years. I don't know if it's the perception of a new administration among students. I don't know if it's the availability of credit not being what it once was, or the fact that student loans now, they're charged a forbearance versus interest free throughout the rest of residency. But yeah, there's definitely been much more interest last couple of years.
These three med students are all on the path to becoming military physicians, but their futures are certainly far from clear. Each is still unsure of their specialty, where they will do their residency, and if they will be deployed. But what is certain is that each is looking forward to what their medical and military careers will bring them. For War News Radio with Emily Crawford, I'm Kyle Crawford.
That's our show for this week.
War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College.
Visit us online to listen to archived shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's at warnewsradio.org.
You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook to keep up with War News Radio between shows. Look for the links on our site.
Our behind-the-scenes crew this week includes Kate Aronoff, Anjali Kadambi, Sam Hirschman, Louis Katz, Rosanna Kim, and Jeremy Rappaport-Stein. Our producer is Jim McMillan. I'm Eliana Viscard-Church.
And I'm Jillian Ma. Until next time, thanks for listening.